Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
CA's finest mad skills, a.k.a. Doug Wilder.
One of the stories you tell here, in 1970, when you were a newly elected senator to the Virginia State Senate representing Richmond, you encountered a problem you couldn't ignore, the state song, Carry Me Back to Old Virginia. And I was reminded of the current situation where this year, where many people were angered by calls to get rid of the Confederate battle flag in some southern states. Was it pretty much the same thing, same arguments?
Yes, it was with me. But, you know, I never knew it was the state song, even though all Virginians were taught to know the song in school. And so when I heard the legislature being entertained one evening by this group and they closed it up with the singing of the song, I couldn't believe it. So I left. Ultimately then drill down, and if you look at the second stanza of the song, it even says that this lamentation of the slave wanted to be reunited with old Massa and old Missus in Virginia. But it even went further. It said even when they died and went to heaven, he never wanted to be separated from old Massa and old Missus. He wanted to be a slave even in heaven. I said, now this is going too far. But even though it took them 17 years or so to deal with that song, they stopped singing it. They never sang it. I never heard it sung again. Now it is considered to be what they call the song emeritus in Virginia. The Confederate flag, in terms of the Confederate emblems, when I was governor of the state of Virginia, I was shocked to learn that they are National Guard. We rang that symbol on the lapels, or rather on their insignia on the sleeves. And I, by executive order, ordered it cut, taken down, and away, and it was. And I didn't deliberate it with it. I didn't argue. I didn't hold meetings. I did it.
But in the first few pages of your book, you include some of the angry letters that were sent to you about your objections to Carry Me Back to Old Virginia. So you've saved them all these years?
I did, and I have them in storage at Virginia Union University. It's a library name for me. And they were just a few of the excerpts. I got letters from all over the world. And people said, how dare you even think about doing this? Look at this song. It was written by a black man. Don't you know that? I said, yes, he wrote some other song. In the evening, by the moonlight, hold him golden slippers. He wrote what he could sell at the time. I don't blame him. But don't tell me I should herald this. And I didn't, and I don't. Took it to the back and sewed an arm on again. Stabbed that man right
in his heart. Gave him a chance before a brand new start. For one thing, one of the things I know as a medical ethicist from my training is that the claims made in the book and elsewhere about the lack of ethical regulations and ethical strictures during this time when the cells were taken from Henrietta Lacks, you know, the claim that, well, there were no medical ethics back then. Scientists and doctors could do basically as they wanted. That's not true. I wrote a review of The Organ Thieves this summer that made the same error, and I pointed out in detail there had been a number of court cases and a number of laws passed that established the right to informed consent as a right in not only U.S. law, but in hospital practice. And so when people keep claiming that these laws didn't exist, whether they mean to or not, this tends to operate against acknowledging the abuse of African Americans, because the reality was that these strictures were sometimes observed when it came to whites, but not observed when it came to black people. So being able to say that they just didn't exist is a way of exonerating researchers who chose not to observe them when it came to African Americans. So I would have written a very different book, and who knows, may yet.
Author Harriet Washington is currently a lecturer in bioethics at Columbia University, former Page One editor at USA Today, has been a research fellow in medical ethics at Harvard.
Virginia Governor Ralph Northam says he is not going anywhere. He's giving interviews on why he is not resigning over a long-ago party to which he admitted wearing blackface and a racist photo in an old yearbook. Here he is on CBS's Face the Nation.
Right now, Virginia needs someone that can heal. There's no better person to do that than a doctor.
No better person than a doctor. A reminder that the governor is a doctor, that racist photo was from Northam's med school yearbook.
It's the second time Jacqueline Johnson cried next to her son Kendrick's grave. The first time he was being lowered into the ground. This time he's being pulled out of it.
Did you ever expect you'd have to exhume his body?
No, I didn't expect to have to bury his body.
In June, Kendrick's body was sent to Florida. The Johnsons hired Dr. Bill Anderson to conduct an independent second autopsy. In that autopsy, Anderson told the Johnsons he found evidence that Kendrick died as the result of a blow to the neck and not accidental asphyxia after slipping into a rolled gym mat at school, as investigators in Georgia had said. But what Dr. Anderson did not find shocked them.
When we got the body for the second autopsy, that organs, the heart, lungs, liver, etc., were not with the body.
The brain,
they were all absent.
Every organ from the top of Kendrick's head to his pelvis gone, and his family had no idea.
We have been let down again. And when we buried Kendrick, we thought we was burying Kendrick, not half of Kendrick.
The cows. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Tuesday, April 13, 2021. So I have been told two major points for this broadcast. Hopefully I'll get to say them several times before we conclude. Sobriety would be best. If a strict component of counter-racism code, because there was a lot of talk about counter-racism, the period where some of the main events of the book that we're discussing today took place during the so-called civil rights era. So if a main component of what they call civil rights counter-racism was, hey, victims of racism, we are about sobriety. The events that we're reading about today may not have happened. Sobriety would be best. The other, I think I've said for years, at least a good decade, I believe, you want to study, learn about racism, white supremacy, especially if you have offspring. Learn about your local history, wherever you happen to be at, your city, your parish, your state, whatever it is. Learn about what has happened there. You can probably learn a lot about white supremacy, racism, even though I've been a gleeful Seattle resident for a long time now. Being a resident born in VA, being an alumnus of the University of Virginia, and someone who talks about white supremacy, racism all the time, felt repugnant that I didn't know about Bruce O'Tucker, but I am still learning. I didn't know about all this. This is just another chapter to follow. Like, wow, all of the eugenics history in Virginia and different elements that we've talked about before, closing of the schools. Bruce O'Tucker, put that in with the Commonwealth as well. Anyway, brief syllabus before we get started, works that would kind of help provide context for the material we will review today. Alan Hornblum, both Acres of Skin and Sentenced to Science. He was a guest on the program and we discussed the latter, but we spent a little time discussing the former. Both are very constructive and deal with abuse of prisoners, mostly black, in Pennsylvania. But specifically, we spent a good bit of time talking about consent and what is informed consent, and how much World War II in the 1940s and the Nuremberg Code, how much that informed consent, and why you would have a turn to experimenting on prison populations, because it would be easier to get around informed consent as opposed to general population, might be more difficult to coerce them, especially into risky experiments. The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, written by Rebecca Skloot, white woman. We read that in the book club. Incidentally, Harriet A. Washington, she was being asked about that book when she pivoted to the book that we're going to discuss today, which is interesting because The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks is referenced in the book that we're going to discuss today. Speaking of which, the legend Harriet A. Washington, we read Medical Apartheid in the book club, top five all time, one of my favorites, and we also read A Terrible Thing to Waste, top 10 all time, stunning that she has two books in my top 10, I guess my favorite author. One of the more, also in my top 10, I guess this might be important subject matter to Gus T., Vincent Woodard, The Delectable Negro, Human Consumption, and Homoeroticism in U.S. Slave Culture, also read in the book club. That's four of the last five read in the book club. And finally, I mean, there are many, many more we could add to it, but we'll round it out with Dana Ramey Berry, The Price for Their Pound of Flesh, The Value of the Enslaved from Womb to Grave. Excellent reading list to accompany the program for today. Not exhaustive. If you want more, just check the footnotes as you're going through some of those titles, and you'll come up with even more books to round out. Our guest for today's broadcast, in addition to writing the book that we're going to discuss, he has a lengthy and illustrious career as a journalist covering a variety of topics in the Commonwealth, the tobacco giants, which I am a little bit curious about as well. But the reason we asked him to visit us today to discuss his most recent work, The Organ Thieves, The Shocking Story of the First Heart Transplant. As I said, I had no idea about Bruce O'Tucker or Doug Wilder's involvement. I guess I should have given a quick before we get to our guest, the intro that we heard. So we heard Doug Wilder talking about Old Virginia, important in this here story about Bruce O'Tucker that we'll discuss. We heard from the great Harriet A. Washington. We heard about our current governor, Ralph Koonman Northam, and him, I guess, doing a successful job fighting off allegations of racism about photos from his time in medical school, where he was either dressed in blackface or in a Klan outfit. And then finally, Kendrick Johnson, murdered, or he at least at minimum died under suspicious circumstances. And then they exhumed the body, and oh, look, his organs are missing as well. Very recent, but very relevant to the discussion for today. Very thankful to have him on the broadcast joining us live. Our guest this evening, the author of the text, Mr. Charles V. Jones. Mr. Jones, are you with us, sir?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. You sound, it's not crystal clear. I don't know if you're on a headset or something, but maybe if you could get closer to the phone.
I had tried. Sorry, Gus. I had tried to get you on a landline and it wouldn't connect, so I'm on my cell phone.
So oh, okay. Well, up. It did improve. I guess if it really
I'll keep it close.
Okay. Spectacular. I guess if it really bothers me, I can ring you. I can dial you on your landline and see if that improves. But it improved once you spoke.
Would you like to do that? Would you like to do that? I mean, I'm fine if you think that's good.
Let's see. Let me check my email to make sure I have the correct number. If I do, We can just do that now and make everyone happy. See if that'll make it a little clearer. Let's see. Going through my email because I think I do have it just in case, just for backup. Okay. Yep. All right.
Yes.
I will. If you want to hang up, I'll go ahead and ring you in. Should be in about no more than 30 seconds.
Okay. Thank you.
Awesome. Let's see. All right, folks. Just give me 30 seconds or so, and we will ring him to the line here. Reading is more important than watching television, as we're waiting for him to rejoin. Thought it would be a little quicker than that. Let's see. Oh, there we go. Wow, that was a long...
You reached Chip Jones, please.
Oh, no, and it still didn't even do right. Gee whiz. Let's see. We'll have to try it again. Let's see. I took a really long time to even ring to then go to the answering service. Let's try again. Let's see. Should be here on Thursday for the book club. Geronimo.
Hello, it's me again. You called my cell. I can.
Oh, whoops!
My
this
other
is
land.
The cell. Oh, wrong one. Wrong sure. one.
No worries. But I can. I'm going to email you my landline again if you still want to try that. Whatever works for you. I'm going to shoot this right back to you, so you have it right. If it help you out.
I grabbed the wrong. Oh, he got. Okay, got the new one. Okay, we'll try that one. Let's see if it does a little bit better. Much obliged, Mr. Jones.
I'm sorry. Sure. Please call me Chip.
Okay, Chip. We'll try it again right now.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm. All righty. We'll try it one more time. Hopefully, we'll get it correct. Let's see. Hopefully, it'll be clearer. Hopefully, all of this in the name of clarity so that it will sound a little bit better. Let's see. And we'll be here on Thursday for the book club.
Hello. Yes, sir.
Oh, a little clearer, I think. A little clearer.
Is that better for you? Good.
Just a little bit. Awesome. So all of that in the name of clarity, as I just said. Awesome.
I'll speak up.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your patience, Chip.
No worries.
As you said. After all of that, for our listeners, this might be their first time hearing from you. Anything that you would like to tell folks about your illustrious Pulitzer Prize nominated career as a journalist and author?
Well, first of all, thanks a lot for having me on. It's a real honor, and I really enjoyed listening to what you had earlier. It's interesting to hear Governor Wilder speaking about his memoir. That was very interesting. I would say, Gus, probably for the... Is this a Seattle-based audience, or is this a national audience?
They're all over. I think some of the folks are not even in the U.S., so...
I heard you say you went to UVA, so I thought that was interesting.
Of course.
You have Virginia roots. I once worked in Charlottesville at the what they call the Daily Regress, unfortunately, the Daily Progress, but it was a good gig back in the day. I would say that the main thing about my reporting career, as you alluded to, writing about big tobacco, that was probably the most interesting 5 years of my reporting career, which was at the Richmond paper, then the Times-Dispatch, because I was the local reporter, as they say, in the maw of the tobacco industry. So when Philip Morris sued ABC for $10 billion, I was kind of in that line of fire. And it was very useful for me for this book, The Organ Thieves, which deals a lot about science and law, ethics, and of course race became, and injustice and systemic racism became its main focus. But I've had a lot of experience in lots of different areas of journalism, but mostly I am just a dyed-in-the-wool reporter who came on a story, as you said, that shocked you or surprised you, and you didn't know about it. And I didn't know about it either, and I followed it as closely and as well as I could in this book. And that's about it.
Much obliged. For folks who have not seen you, you are a white man. Is that correct?
Yes.
Right on. Before actually we get to the nuts and bolts of the book, and we can try to cover as much as we can, hopefully get some questions from listeners as well. Regarding your time covering big tobacco, it says that you all did all this great research on Philip Morris's their USA top secret nicotine research program. Like, what was that all about? What was in this research program?
Well, back in the 50s, Gus, Philip Morris was doing intensive research basically on how to boost the power of every cigarette. I think Stan Glantz, I think he was at UCF in the San Francisco, and a lot of our articles are in those archives if anyone's ever interested. He and other experts compared the Marlboro cigarette to basically a highly developed spacecraft with all the chemistry that went into it at a time when, you know, America really smoked a lot. And there's a crossover and a tie-in with my book, because I start in the 50s, actually in San Francisco at Stanford Medical Center, at a time when Eisenhower had a huge heart attack in the mid-50s, and this was a major, you know, world event at the time, because we were in the thick of the Cold War. So it was interesting for me that a lot of the research that I uncovered through court documents, through interviews, and various other ways in the 90s really kind of had their roots in the 50s and 60s. In Richmond, if you ever, Gus, drove through 95 on I-95, or any of your listeners on the I-95 corridor, right south of the downtown Richmond, there's those huge pylons that show the Marlboro cigarette. That's where the top secret lab was, and that's where they had rats that were injected with huge amounts of nicotine and God knows what else. I can't remember off the bat, but I mean, it was a highly secretive affair, highly litigated and highly protected until the mid 90s, when various whistleblowers came forth. There was one named Victor DeNoble, I remember, who was in the news. There was a lot on 60 Minutes about Jeffrey Wiegand when he was at Brown and Williamson. So I was very fortunate as a reporter to be able to track down a lot of these people and to report on this huge industry, which people in Richmond, Virginia, the state capital, really, you know, admired and reveled in because they made a lot of money. And, you know, Philip Morris, when you talk about race issues, they were very smart as far as luring in the African-American community and organizations of the day with lots of money as a way to legitimize their activity, you know, which essentially, you know, addicted, you know, millions of smokers and created a lot of heart and lung disease, and still does. So that's what was happening in Richmond, and it still is in some ways. I mean, they're developing these so-called smokeless products, but I've been away from it so long that for me it was, you know, more about 20 years ago to break all those stories and to do nothing but dig into a very powerful corporation.
Hmm. Wow, we context of white supremacy, I guess, to the final point. Experimentation, lots of secretive study, but to the final point, if folks have been listening to The Cows long enough, 2016, Professor Valerie Yerger was on the program, and she, that's what she does, her study of nicotine and racism and the effort to why there's lots of extra advertising for nicotine products, and particularly the new menthol, that's the one, menthol cigarettes, to promote those to black people and the health impact. You can even connect that with COVID and all the respiratory issues, but very, that was why I said we have to sidestep, but not really, because I thought that was important, but now we can kind of get back to the organ thieves. Very important, though. Valerie Yerger, go back and check out the archives for listeners. So Chip Jones with the organ thieves. I guess before we get started, a question we ask all of our guests who come on the program. I use the term racism and the word white supremacy. I use them as synonyms. I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows. A global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
Well, I certainly wouldn't say it was inaccurate. Certainly, I, as a white person, I've grown up. I grew up around Washington D.C. in the late '60s, I was not. I was not young enough to see the most visible forms of what you're talking about, abusing and subject. You know, water fountains and. Even the schools had desegregated by the late '60s, where I was. I think that certainly, with the storming of the U.S. Capitol in January, the disturbing imagery, the disturbing images, the flags, the attitudes, the words. I mean, it feels to me, Gus, like a we're talking about cancer. It feels to me like a cancer that hasn't gone away and needs to keep being treated and as actively as possible. And however, my book or my research or the questions that come out of it, and even people who disagree with it, I heard Harriet Washington on there questioning some of the, and she did write about that the only negative review of the book, actually. About prior consent, which wasn't my focus, and I fully admit not being an expert as she is on that topic. But I just think that whatever, in fact, I know, and I can tell you about some things that have already happened at Virginia Commonwealth because of the book to try to raise awareness of everybody, white and black educators at the university here are actually doing, they created a new program, my understanding, in basically history and medicine. And I've been told that the book helped spark that. And I'm hoping one of the things I could say on the side, Gus, is one of the things I've been doing since the publication of the book is trying to get an official apology from the university and the state of Virginia. You mentioned Ralph Northam. I've shared the book with the Secretary of Education. I'm meeting with some, I've met with some legislators, and one of my goals is also to help to do whatever I can do for the survivors in the Tucker family to get some type of apology, some type of honoring, and if this is what they want, and it's their decision, you know, some type of compensation, which never, if you read the book, you'll see they never got a penny out of a civil trial for wrongful death in 1972, and it was the first wrongful death lawsuit filed in the United States over a heart transplant, and it still has not been recognized officially. And so I take it as my, you know, responsibility as the author of this book to keep plugging. I am not an activist by nature, to be honest. I'm a writer, I'm an observer, and I'm a reporter. But on this one, until there's some type of redress of what happened in a way that the people I know in the family are happy with, you know, I'm going to keep pushing.
much obliged for the response. If I can, and for the detail with all of that as well, if I can make a request, this is a request I make frequently sure. with our white guests. Sometimes white people, individuals classified as white, practice racism by not answering questions, particularly if the subject is about racism, white supremacy, or they will be very, they'll be circumloquacious with their response to where you can lose whether or not you actually got an answer to your question. So I do want to make sure that we cover as much as we can and that we get direct answers. You can give us your responses and give us the background and all that. That's great. But to make sure we get direct responses. So to the definition of racism, white supremacy, and if you don't agree, that's fine too. Not all of our guests agree. Do you think the definition I gave is accurate? Do you think such a system exists?
I think that a system of racism is still at play in the United States, yes.
And specifically the definition that I gave, because some people have different concepts, different ways that they define that system. So I just want to make sure the definition that I gave, a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think that definition for the system of racism is accurate?
You know, I'm on the spot about thinking about this real quickly, and so I have no disagreement with it. I mean, and when I think of it, I think about the symptoms of it. So yes, but I have to be honest, I can't wrap my brain around it that quickly, maybe because it's the evening here, but I don't disagree with it. I hope that's direct enough.
Okay. Don't disagree is a double negative, just as writers. Anywho, you did mention in your response, I was paying attention, you mentioned growing up close to the D.C. area and kind of being young enough that you weren't really there for like the white only, black only fountains and all the rest of that kind of direct, more blatant forms of racism, white supremacy. One component of racism that I have talked about, noted for years, especially with white guests, racist jokes. If you grew up in the D.C. area anywhere close to the 1970s or so, like I would think you heard at least 5, maybe 50 racist jokes. Have you heard at least one? And if you could recall one, because that's what I just told you about. Frequently white people, they are not honest when they talk to non-white people, black people, about racism. I found that racist jokes, that's one of the few times when white people speak honestly. Are there any jokes that you remember hearing? Can you share one with us?
I am not a joke teller on any front, whether it's racist or non-racist, but I can speak to about 15 years ago here in Richmond. Someone referred to a basketball team. I remember it was UNLV, and they referred to them, instead of as the Running Rebs, as the Running N-word. That's the only recent. And I told the guy, no, you know, that's wrong. Don't say that. And that's the last time I remember someone giving me a blatantly racist joke. Growing up around D.C., like I said, I was fortunate because when I got in the Key Club, it was because a black friend got me into the Key Club. We were fortunate, my wife and I, going over to the cellar door. Some of the best jokes I heard were from Richard Pryor and Dick Gregory when I was in college there. So I was able to hear some interesting, deconstruction of what was going on around us in the early 70s. But I don't have any jokes I can pull out for you.
Fascinating. UNLV. Dick Gregory, the late former guest on The Cows as well. Before I hop to the book specifically, there was an author, non-white author, he wrote in a national publication, he was writing about racism, and he said that white people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism, but rarely pained enough. And I've been asking our white guests for some years now, the first portion of that sentence, white people are often greatly and sincerely pained by racism. Just you as a white man, the white people that you've been around, your time on the planet, do you think that a substantial number of white people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism?
Yes, and I don't think that just feeling the pain is enough. I think that sometimes, as you're indicating, I mean, words aren't enough. So yes, I think there's a lot of pain, and I think that not only my white friends, but my black friends have been pained by racism, and my relatives who I've been fortunate that we have a very diverse family have been pained as well. So yes,
let's. Thank you for the explicit answer there. In the context of this story that we're about to get into with Bruce O'Tucker, do you think the white people that you've written about here at MCV, they demonstrated in some way that they were sincerely and greatly pained about racism and in the context of Bruce O'Tucker specifically?
No. The people now at MCV?
The people that you wrote about, the people that the main characters in this book that we're going to talk about,
any of them
sincerely and greatly pained about racism and or what happened with Bruce O'Tucker?
No, and that was what was it. That's the narrative that I tried to share, that there was not any awareness of it or pain.
That right there, that contradiction, because it was very clear, yes, white people that you're around are sincerely and greatly pained, but in this story, there's not one white person that I can point to. We're about to get into the details, but there's not one that I can point to that was sincerely or greatly pained, like this was really a bad thing and we should have done better by it. Did I miss that?
Yes, there was one, and you mentioned the the Nuremberg code of ethics. There's a doctor in here, Norm Sporn, who was observing the lack of conscientious information given to all patients, but especially to black patients at MCV in the 60s. And he confronted Dr. David Hume, who was the department chair, and said that basically, you know, Dr. Hume, you're not telling these prospective patients the chances of mortality are high, and he even after all these years, you know, he did express pain about that. He's someone who shared his own observations from the MCV and also the segregated hospital, which was called St. Philip's. And he's the person that shared the, racist term for it was the black Calcutta. Now, what that meant was, you know, basically the view that this was a kind of a combination of India and whatever, you know, Africa, or just it was a place that white residents wanted to treat they would see the worst diseases. So he was someone there who I interviewed who did express some level of pain and about that. But in terms of the major characters who were doing the work on Bruce Tucker, not a lot of regret. And that's why the book surprised a lot of people.
Even within that response, I was paying attention. I didn't really hear Bruce Tucker, because that was what I said. Someone sticking up and saying, oh man, Bruce Tucker specifically got it bad. This was a more general lament about, oh man, black people in general were treated bad. And you have been interrupting me a little bit, and I have not interrupted you. I think that is really important to make sure I get to finish with my statements. Much obliged, sure. Chip. Much obliged. But you did adjust a more kind of a general regret from this white person some years after, and to me that does not count at all. A white person in a system of racism that is still ongoing saying something that happened 40, 50 years ago that, oh, this was kind of bad and we could have done better, like, that is worth not even a peanut. I mean, really. Mm-hmm. And it's not even, as you stated, most white people don't even do that. So,
right. At
any rate, just to make sure that we can get, I don't want to bog down on that, just to make sure we can kind of get to some of the nuts and bolts of the story, you mentioned Invisible Man in the text. We read that in the book club. This is from chapter 12, and then you can kind of tell us a little bit about who Bruce O'Tucker was, the main victim, I guess. Yeah, victim. No equivocation, the victim in the story, Bruce O'Tucker. But you write, Mr. Tucker entered the hospital without friends or family members, even worse, in terms of medical decision-making about his terminality as a patient. He entered the hospital with alcohol on his breath and on his clothes. Sobriety would be best. The profiling of Tucker as a charity patient fits a pattern of behavior chronicled by Sudnow, and other academic researchers in the late 1960s as public hospitals such as MCV. In the case of Bruce Tucker, Letterer writes, physician concern about his recovery was colored by his race, socioeconomic class, and alcohol use. Bruce Tucker was the medical equivalent of the novelist Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, one passage from the award-winning 1952 novel about the black experience in America seemed to foreshadow the Richmond factory worker's tragic end. Everywhere I've turned, somebody wants to sacrifice me for my good. Ellison writes, only they were the ones who benefited, and now we start on the old sacrifice merry-go-round. At what point do we stop? Always love a good quote from Ralph Ellison. Bruce O'Tucker, why did you even want to tell this story?
I wanted to tell the story because I'd never been told before. It was out there, it was under everyone's noses, and as you mentioned with Governor Wilder, it was something that he mentioned in his memoir, but it was not explored in any more depth by him, and he was gracious enough to after many entreaties on my part to give an on the record interview. And once Governor Wilder had spoken to me about it and explained to me the tragic and racist treatment of Bruce Tucker, I knew that it was a story that I needed to follow, and I had to follow.
Did you have concerns being a white man telling this story?
Yes, in terms of knowing that I would have to make sure that I was aware of whatever biases I would bring to the story, the things I couldn't know as a white man, yes.
Okay. When did you start working on this project?
Began thinking about it in late 2016, began in earnest in early 2017 with the interview with Governor Wilder. Left my job the next year and spent 2 years writing it, and it came out last August.
Okay. So 3 years, roughly, it seems?
Roughly three.
Okay. It seems like you invested, like, a good amount of legwork. Like, you were just talking about doing some of the traveling to try to, you already talked about speaking with former Governor Wilder and then trying to track down Mr. Tucker's son, takes up kind of a good chunk of the conclusion of the book. Like, how much time and investment, like, in terms of research and then trying to interview people, mm-hmm. was put into this project?
Gus, I'd say I put in a solid year and a half into the research and a year in the writing and editing. It was, so for a book, it was not, that's not a long time. But I felt I could get it done, and it turned out to come out a turning point in American history last year. So I'm glad it came out when it did.
Fascinating. Before we get to Bruce O'Tucker, the black male whose heart delectable Negro organs were consumed in his heart and kidneys, actually, You give a little bit of the background of this body theft, and I wanted to give kind of two passages to get your response. This is in chapter 2, The Resurrectionists, which is, there you go, right there. But you write, using the coded language of a city and state founded on buying and selling Africans to work in fields and factories, Warner blithely bragged from the peculiarity of our institutions, materials for dissection can be obtained in abundance, and we believe are not surpassed if equaled by any city in our country. The number of Negroes employed in our factories will furnish materials for the support of an extensive hospital and afford to the student that great desideratum, clinical instruction. Now, I'm skipping down just like a page or two, still in chapter 2. You continue, the medical school professors in Richmond spoke in a secret jargon similar to their peers at Harvard, Columbia, and elsewhere. The gauzy, semi-mystical lingo seems to have been adopted to provide a sort of verbal cushion. It softened the hard reality of an illegal activity that could not be easily explained or justified outside the confines of the dissecting room. So, for example, the grave robber was called a resurrectionist, a strange, religiously fraught term that would have been comical if the work had not been so despicable. Resurrection is a colorful description of a cemetery raid to raise a body from the dead to be used for study of anatomy. Historian Susan M. Schultz explains, the term resurrectionist was coined because it was commonly believed that burial ground was sacred and that the removal of the body from God's acre was an interference with the plan of Providence and the Great Resurrection. Thus, resurrectionists and body snatchers became synonymous. Just can you talk about how some of this languaging was used, in my opinion, to be deceptive, as you said, to cushion, to be euphemistic about what was happening?
Well, yes. I'm not an academic historian, so for me as a journalist, to read these letters from the earliest days of Medical College of Virginia, and then also to see actually that they were following in the path of Harvard and Columbia, it just blew my mind, Gus. I mean, and I think that if you want to look at modern, there's a modern equivalence we can go to, you know, when people euphemize whatever they're saying. You use euphemisms, you know, talking about, you know, the peculiar institution, just that, talking about slavery as a peculiar institution. They wouldn't just say it. It just showed that in quote-unquote polite society, in antebellum South, it was the way that they used language to do bad stuff. If I can summarize it, I want to be direct. I don't want to talk. You told me I've been too loquacious, so I want to be. That's basically it. It's just, you know, misuse of language.
Context of white supremacy. Talk about that all the time. Correct use of words, calling things mm-hmm. by their proper name. I want to read a passage, but before I read it, in this enterprise, because this reminded me of medical apartheid, where she talked about how black people would be used in this business of being a resurrectionist, or you're going to go out and retrieve these body parts for us at these white-dominated institutions. Who is old Chris?
Chris Baker. Chris Baker was the son of one of the employees in the early days of the Medical College of Virginia, and he lived in, he was given room and board, actually, in the bottom of this very strange building called the Egyptian Building. I say strange because it's still there today, and it looks weird. We can go into that later. And he was basically the middleman that worked with mostly, I believe, white criminal elements in Richmond, who would and Chris and these guys too, I think, also spied on funerals of black families during the day, and then at night would go out and dig them up and bring them back to the medical school and use them and clean them off and use them for dissection. And he, again, one of these things that just shocked me, blew my mind as I got into the research, he actually lived there with his family until roughly, I believe, about 1919, which shocked me as well. I mean, this was not something in the, quote, antebellum South. This was in the, you know, Jim Crow era of the South, but it was also after World War One. He was still at MCV. And I've talked to Sean Utsi is the chair of the VCU, Department of African-American Studies, and Sean did a really great documentary. If anyone's interested, they can look him up, and I'm sure they can find that. It's in my book. It's cited in my book, and Sean gave me an interview, and it's very, very eye-opening for me to learn more about the historical context of Chris Baker, because obviously he was a victim as well of the system.
I would agree 1,000%. This is in medical apartheid, where this figure, old Chris, is repeat. Talk about patterns within the system of racism, white supremacy. I'll sneak in a quick passage. You write, this is in chapter 4. Anatomy programs were required to post a bond of $1,000, and body snatching was made a felony, punishable by 5 to 10 years in the penitentiary. Initially, the law seems to have curbed some of the illicit trafficking of corpses, since bodies now could be legally donated to medical schools. And yet the crusading editor, Mitchell, knew from his sources that old Chris was still being sent out on some late-night cemetery raids. Others occurred in broad daylight. In the summer of 1896, Mitchell learned that Baker had been sent to the nearby Virginia State Penitentiary to take possession of a newly executed prisoner named Solomon Marble. The fearless Mitchell promptly organized a group of angry citizens who rushed to the college building to reclaim the body of the convicted murderer after it was transported to the college and packed in a barrel of salt for preservation. Delectable Negro. To enhance Mitchell's story, The Planet included sketches of the scenes of the raucous intervention and protest. Their outrage was understandable considering the continued desecration and plundering of African American burial grounds at a time when lynchings, meant to enforce white supremacy and intimidate blacks through terrorism, often went unpunished throughout the South. Anything you wanted to add, Chip?
John Mitchell, I mean, he's a heroic figure in my mind, and he's actually part of the current debate at the University of Richmond, where the professors and the black students are trying to get a building named after him. So he's still in the news.
Context of white supremacy, Charles V. Jones, the organ thieves. So getting to Bruce O. Tucker, I guess you can kind of explain how he ends up being the non-consenting, unwinning donor in all of this, and unfortunately, alcohol. Is that to make sure I'm not being incorrect? If Bruce O. Tucker was about sobriety, maybe you don't have a book to write? Is that accurate?
Maybe. I think it's an unknown. But I think the fact that he was a black man with nobody stepping up while he was in the emergency room to find him, and a sense that was explained to me by a doctor who was there on the scene that he might not be there, he might not pay his bills, led to a morally wrong assumption that he was a piece of flesh and not a human being. So the alcohol, I think, only added to the, whatever people's biases were on the fact that he had suffered a head injury while he was drinking. And but he was, his heart was strong. His vital signs were good. The fact that the white doctors kept him alive for the next 21 hours or so in order to transplant his heart into the body of a white businessman, I think that shows that with his organs, he was alive until they pulled the plug and they violated the law. They were not charged with any felonies, but they did wind up in court on a civil lawsuit brought by Governor Wilder, who was not governor then, but he was a young attorney on behalf of the Tucker family. So he was someone who did not deserve to be treated again, and this is why historically, as I saw the founding principles of the university, I could see a historical pattern at play in modern times. And that's how it clicked for me, Gus, because, again, I'm a reporter following the story, and I had to learn a lot of this history on the run.
At this period, 1960, and you even give some of the context for when this is all happening, 1968, and we've just had the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, caused all kinds of upheaval, riots in Washington, D.C., and many other places throughout the U.S., and so-called desegregation of schools. Of course, we talked about in Virginia, they closed their schools. Book written by that title, Prince Edward County, they closed the schools for 5 years as opposed to have black children in school with little white children. So all of this is kind of happening in the backdrop. Even MCV and colleges, are we going to have Negro students in the medical school and all of this? All of this is in the backdrop of when this is taking place. So even if the circumstances were the same, if they have a white guy, a rich white man who is in need of a heart transplant desperately, might die, and they have a white guy who's come in, same age, everything else is the same. He's got smells of alcohol, had some sort of freak accident, falls off a stoop or what have you. And they don't, he's by himself, doesn't have family. A white guy comes in, do you think they behave any differently? Do they treat this person any differently if it's a white person, not Mr. Tucker, black male?
Yes, I think undoubtedly. I think that the way that they coerced a junior medical examiner to give a green light to something that was not, that was against the law, because there was a 24-hour waiting period that was on the books at the time to do anything with an organ. I think that his blackness did change things. I mean, I can never know. It's a hypothetical, but to your question, yes.
In the review that you talked about, Harriet A. Washington, she writes, Chip Jones, The Organ Thieves, which tells the story of what happened to Bruce Tucker, disappoints with its pedestrian language telling omissions and hagiographic portrayals of medical actors. Jones doesn't stop to interject at key moments in the narrative. To take one example, researchers rationalize their treatment of Tucker by thinking of him as a charity patient, the kind charged less for substandard care in rat-infested segregated wards in exchange for being conscripted into research. Such coercion is and was unethical and should not just be treated as another story detail. Moreover, it should have been made abundantly clear that no amount of money could have bought an African-American a bed in a standard ward. Medicare had enforced hospital desegregation via the 1964 Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, but de facto segregation and healthcare bias lingered even in the North. What are your response to those critiques from Ms. Washington?
I'd prefer not to respond too much to that critique because I think that she's entitled to her opinion about how she read the book. But I just prefer to say that I was presenting the facts as I knew them. She's a brilliant writer, and she makes some fair points, but I was taking the story as I knew it from the documents that I had at the time. Excuse me. And I would say that that the issue about prior consent was something that it was that in terms of how MCV was operating at the time. My information from the documents on file in the court case presented by Governor Wilder to me, you know, verbally and in the court case, I was just following the trial facts as I knew them. So she has a legitimate view to her own, you know, points about it, but those are hers, you know. And I think she has a book that's just out. So I wish her well.
Much obliged, Charles V. Jones. You in the book, or I guess even before I get to the specific point in the book, I'll ask it or approach the question this way. Could you name someone that you think would accurately be described as an angel?
Could I name someone?
Yes, sir.
May I ask you, I don't mean to answer your question with a question, but I have to ask, why do you ask me about angels? I'm not sure. The context.
Oh, the context is coming. I'm going to give it to you afterwards. That's why I said I'm going to do it this way. I'm going to reverse it because I almost did give you the context first, but I'm going to do it this way. So the context is coming, but just without context, if you can think of anyone that you would say, oh, yeah, if you were going to say that this, if you needed me to describe someone as a quote-unquote angel, this is the person I would select.
I can think of people I would describe as an angel.
You said you can or can't?
I can.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Could you give name one or two maybe?
Well, my wife I would describe as an angel.
Okay, right on. Good husband. Any other folks?
Oh, I've known many, many people in my life, Gus, that have treated me well at key points. I can think of. I can think of people who helped me when my brother died when I was a teenager in California. Good friends after all these years, people. So I would name my best friend Chris from 29 Palms, California. He's an angel. And my best friend Tom from San Diego. They're angels.
Okay. Wife, Tom. And Chris, those were three folks you named as angels.
Sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The context, this, I'm moving forward. This is chapter 11. Sobriety would be best. As everyone shared the wine, they talked. Well, let me even back a little more and give a little more context. Bruce Tucker settled back on a brick wall, lighting a cigarette. That's horrible, too. He took in some of the latest news. There was a story in the Richmond Afro-American Importance of Black Journalists about a preacher arrested in a civil rights protest after his son had been handcuffed. The black-owned newspaper served its news straight up. On that, everyone could agree. It was better than the Morning Times Dispatch or Evening News Leader, which only gave the white point of view. As everyone shared the wine, the talk turned to Dr. King's assassination in Memphis and the city's striking sanitation workers. If it could happen to Martin, couldn't it happen anywhere? The recent arrests of the Richmond pastors made them wonder. Though Bruce Tucker and his friends were hardly acting like angels, if anyone needed help, they knew it was right around the corner at a large Baptist church. I'll stop there. The context, when I read that, this is a metaphor, and for anyone who listens to the cows, they know I have encouraged readers, speakers of language, to pay attention to metaphors, because in the system of white supremacy, they often frequently support white supremacy racism. This metaphor specifically is generally applied to black people. Someone not, in fact, it's so cliche, I generally say that they, and I think it's not even I, generally in terms of writing, they say, stay away from stale metaphors. Old catchphrases and things that people just say all the time, you should try and avoid that, switch it up, let's be fresh, creative, use your imagination. But this one specifically is so stale and old, it's not just Gus's who is saying this now. They have lots of reports. I just went and tried to see what I could find sleepily I gave myself 10 minutes. What can I find? This is what I found just in 10 minutes before I went to bed. He was no angel. The rallying cry of the lynching bee. That's by Yannick Giovanni Marshall. I didn't even save that one. Next, Michael Brown, 18, due to being buried on Monday, was no angel, with public records and interviews with friends and family revealing both problems and promise in his young life. That's from the New York Times. Next, Janice Armstrong, Trayvon Martin was no angel, but does that merit a death sentence? 2012. Next, George Floyd was not an angel. Howard Kurtz said on air last week he was a drug addict who initially resisted arrest. Yet I'm not seeing too many commentators saying Derek Chauvin is getting a raw deal and being charged with second-degree murder and manslaughter. You get the pattern? I don't see anybody, for example, say, now that Thomas Jefferson was no angel. It's always a black person, and generally a black male, who's been killed or choked or stabbed or died and they stole his heart, who we got to make sure that he was no way. I don't want anybody to be thinking this guy was perfect or anything like that. That's why I asked the question. And the first person you named is your wife. Is your wife a white person or a non-white person?
She's an angel.
Is she a white? Is she classified as a white or a non-white angel?
She's classified as a white angel guy.
Okay, there we go. That's in the system of white supremacy. We get lots of depictions as white Jesus and white God
that.
And white being the supreme spiritual figure. And it tends to be the exact opposite, where black people, it's the devil's food cake and the black devil. Michael Brown was no angel. We got to make sure we emphasize. That's why I asked for the context. Does that make any sense why I asked that question?
Yes, it does.
Is it logical?
I think you make a fair point, and it is a cliche, and I think, again, you make a good point.
Okay. Context of white supremacy for listeners, if you all have questions. The number is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound, *61 if you have a question. That word fair, very important. We talk about that on the program all the time. I'll see if I can weave in a few of the callers who have questions as I try and get in the rest of my questions about the book we're discussing, The Organ Thieves, the author Charles V. Jones, with us live. Caller at 0747. Did you have a question for Mr. Jones? You should be with us, sir.
Greetings, Gus, all the callers and listeners. And thank you, Mr. Jones, for consenting to the interview. I found a lot of constructive information in your text. I just wanted to pivot back to the passage that Gus described about the medical professors and their secret jargon about grave robbing, calling them resurrectionists, and describing the junior professors as demonstrators. Do you think, and this may also parallel what Gus was talking about in terms of the use of the word angel. Do you think that you also engage in this type of coded language in your text in order to minimize the crime of racism, white supremacy?
I hope not.
Is that your answer?
Yeah. I mean, I can't say that I don't, obviously, right? So I did not intentionally engage in any coded language or white supremacy in the text. In fact, the opposite is my goal. And I am glad that I've been able to to bring out a story that had never been told, and I did it to the best of my ability. I certainly don't mind the constructive criticism that I'm getting here, and I don't have a debate with it because it's undeniable that there is implicit bias in language and in people, I hope that the book serves a better and a broader purpose than any of its failings might seem to indicate.
Well, what brought this to mind for me was, for example, when you were describing the late 1960s and the dedication of the white Richmond citizens to maintain segregation and white supremacy, you described them as woefully behind the times. Do you think that's an accurate statement?
I'm sorry, I described who was woefully behind the times? I couldn't hear that.
The white citizens of Richmond. You were describing in a passage about Governor Wilder, and he was taking on the case of Mr. Tucker.
Yes. Okay.
And I guess the white citizens were dedicated to still engaging in white supremacy.
Right.
This is the late 1960s, during your upbringing. And you described them as woefully behind the times.
That Richmond was behind the times? Richmond was definitely
woefully.
They were definitely behind the times.
So who was woefully?
The white establishment of Richmond. I'm sorry, I'm not taking your point at all. You're keen on the word woefully.
Did they regret in any way that they were dedicated to white supremacy, or you're the one that has regret?
I don't have the book.
You were woeful.
But I know that Doug Wilder felt that they were behind the times. Whether he said to me woefully or not, I'd have to go through my notes. But that was certainly the sense that Mr. Wilder described the times as for him, as someone who was still working for racial justice. So,
okay. Another example. You had a passage in your book talking about the top-ranked black student of MCV, the Korean War veteran, Charlie Christian,
uh-huh.
who was excluded from the graduation for social functions. And I can't imagine the trauma this poor man underwent after being a Korean War veteran,
mm-hmm.
number one in his class.
Mm-hmm.
And you referred to the despicable behavior of MCV as a troubled legacy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that accurately characterizes their behavior?
I'm hearing you don't think it did.
I just want to know what you think.
Whatever words I used in the book, yes, I did think that when I wrote that. And obviously,
okay.
it didn't work for you, and that's fine. But Mr. Christian,
and the last example. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Mr. Christian's treatment, Dr. Christian's treatment, was something that had been forgotten as part of the narrative of the city of Richmond, and had never been tied to this operation. So by bringing that out, I think I did something constructive. Now, if you don't like the phrasing, I'm sorry. That's understandable. I mean, we can all disagree on exact word choice, and I'm not perfect. I'm no angel, right?
Interesting. And my last example, I don't want to take up too much of your time, and I appreciate you taking my questions. You described the entrenched white male government leadership in the Virginia General Assembly and Governor's Mansion,
mm-hmm.
and this is during the time of the trial,
mm-hmm.
they were shaped by a code of J. gentlemanly behavior.
Well, that's what they call it.
Well, you didn't challenge that in the book, as I recall.
Oh, I certainly did. I totally disagree. I mean, the reason I brought it out was for people who've never been to Virginia, like Gus has. The whole supposed Virginia way of doing things. I wasn't holding this up or glorifying it. I was describing it, and I was exposing it. So, you know, again, you're entitled to your opinion on it, and I hope you'll read the book with an open mind. I think anyone who's listening, I hope they learn something from it, as imperfect as it is.
Oh, I learned quite a bit. And what I found interesting is that I knew.
Oh, hang on, sir. I want to make sure we get as many of our callers as
we can.
All right,
I'm sorry to take up your time.
No apologies. Just want to make sure we get to our callers, other folks who have questions.
Quick side note. You didn't tell me how long this was going to be going, so I had it down for an hour. So if you can give me kind of a time frame on this, I'd appreciate it.
We have 40 minutes left in the broadcast, to make sure we get our callers. People, and okay. Hey, some folks that read the book, they were prepared. They already read The Organ Thief, so they have questions directly from the text. Our person caller at 2262. Did you have a question for Charles V. Jones?
And Gus, can you please just refer to me as Chip?
Oh yes, my bad. He did ask Chip. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. That's what's on the book, and people won't remember it.
Yes, Chip. Chip Jones. Jones. Caller at 2262. Did you have a question for Chip?
Hello, Gus. Hello, everyone. I hope for a caller. No, I don't. You could just bring back on and let other callers who have read the book ask a much more impactful question. But thank you.
Oh, right on. Gracious. Right on. Let's see. I guess I don't know. Should I come back after the other people? I don't even. How does he know the other people have the book who called in? That's interesting. Let's see. The person. Retired firefighter in Florida. That confused me a little bit. Let's see. Did you have a question for Chip Jones?
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the guests. Greetings, everybody. I just came in on the line, but I think a question, if it haven't already been asked to the guests, if he wrote, I think you're talking about a book, right?
Yes, sir.
To the guests, who did you when you was writing the book or the idea of the book? Who did you want to target to share this information to? And what kind of constructive results that you wanted to get from writing the book?
Yes, sir. I wanted to write the book for a broad audience, everybody, and that's why this is great to be on the show. The results, the first thing I wanted to do was to expose the injustice that had been committed upon this black man, Bruce Tucker, and the lack of sensitivity or any kind of justice for his family. And now, as I said earlier, that's my goal, to try to get an official apology from the university and possibly from the state of Virginia.
Okay. Based on the reviews that you probably have gotten by now, I don't know for sure. You may have just wrote the book yesterday, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know. But based on the reviews, who do you think has been responding to your book, white people or non-white people?
It has been across the board, black, white, Latinx. But I will say this: I've had some of the most interesting and educational, for me personally, interviews with black commentators and radio and podcast hosts, excuse me, such as Gus. I think the most passion about the mistreatment that is exposed and written about in the book, I definitely have felt among my fellow Americans who are black.
One last question. How old are you?
I am 68 years old.
Oh, okay. You don't sound like it. All right, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. Always good to get a compliment in, I reckon. I included in the audio segment that we started off with, we had current governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia, Ralph Kuhnman Northam, as he was affectionately known in medical school while he was at Eastern Virginia Medical School. Did that happen? All of the big controversy about him being in blackface, whether he was the Klansman or in blackface, did that happen while you were still working on the Organ Thieves?
It was pretty, no, sir. No, I was done. Yeah, that's a good question, but I was wrapping it up and I was, you know, astounded and offended. And I think the fact that Northam has managed to somehow do whatever he's done and stay in office is going to be the topic of lots of books, which I won't write.
Do you think the fact that this photograph took place while he was a med student in Virginia, do you think that's relevant to this story of Bruce O. Tucker?
You know, in my research, yes, in a sense. I hadn't thought about that, Gus, because as I said, it wasn't the material for my book and it wasn't in the scope of my research. But one of the really disturbing things that I found in my research was this sort of privileged white frat boy behavior among medical students up into, I didn't know that, honestly, that it would have lasted into the late 60s or early 70s. I knew that it happened up until the 40s, maybe the 50s. And it was a real lack of treating bodies with respect at dissection classes, especially, I think, black bodies. So that's a good point.
Something I thought, I've said that consistently. I think I said medical apartheid, that this was not just him hanging out for Halloween or what have you. This was while he's in med school. Like, that says a lot about medical, lots of things in terms of medical treatment of black people. Did you actually see the 1969 film Change of Mind?
No, I just read about it. I would like to see that. Did you see it?
I did. I had never heard of it until reading your book here.
Okay. I need to watch it.
Yes, you should. Like, okay. Wow. For listeners, so it's set in 1969, so this is a year after the assassination of Dr. King. They have this rich white man, and he gets a brain transplant to a black male body. And so everyone is going crazy and this, wow, science. Blah, blah. And so some of his white friends come to see him in the hospital and they're just like, oh my gosh, it's a black guy. Like, ugh, I don't touch him. Like, I'm going to get out of here. And so they leave. His wife's like, I flick out every time he touches me. Like, ugh, it's a black person. Then, by the time they get to the end, he works as an attorney. He works as the prosecuting attorney in the city, and he's trying to prosecute a white police officer for killing a black prostitute, cowbell.
Oh, wow.
This white police officer is saying, this nigger is not going to question me. Oh, and it's played by Leslie Nielsen. Talk about O.J. Simpson, who's mentioned in the book, Naked Gun. It's played by freaking Leslie Nielsen, is the cop who has killed this black female prostitute. And so I almost made a sound clip of it. He gets on the stand and gives this really, it's amazing. By the time we get to the end of the film,
the white brain that has been transplanted. They even have this discussion about, so is this a white man in a black body? Is this a black man with a white brain? Like, anyway, by the time they get to the end, he's an Uncle Tom, the end, and his wife still hates him.
Oh, my gosh.
But change of mind. Whew. Wow. It's on YouTube. You can watch it at your leisure.
I'm glad to made you aware of it. I need to go back. You know, when you write a book, you have a lot of sources of information, so I need to go back and watch that.
Wacky all the way. Caller in New Jersey, victim of racism in New Jersey, did you have a question for Chip Jones? Should be with us.
Yes. How you doing, sir? I didn't get a chance to read the book, and I'm also coming in late. But we're talking about organ donors and black bodies. I just want to know, have your research led you to look at Madame Lalor down in New Orleans, a slave owner who decapitated her slaves and you know, sold body parts on other slaves? Is there any correlation between that history and what we see now as relates to black bodies and organ donors? And also, did you do any research on the New Jersey corruption probe into the organ donor trafficking case?
I did not, to be honest, on both counts. I've written them down, though. That's a very good, that's interesting. Maybe Gus can comment on the Madam in New Orleans, but on neither count, no, those are new to me.
Yes, yes. Okay, but like I said, it'll just be real interesting. I just wanted to know, did your book go that deep into black bodies and organ donors and organ trafficking? All right.
Well, it did. More of my focus was more on not so much the stolen organs around the country as stolen bodies around the country in the creation of the medical education system as we know it from the late 1700s into the 1900s. So that was more of my focus.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Yes, sir.
Caller in the DMV, in fact, aspiring med school student, I'm curious to know if she knew about Bruce O. Tucker being someone right in the Commonwealth. Namaste, Emmy. Did you know about Bruce O. Tucker? They stole his heart to give to a white person.
Greetings, everyone. Greetings, Seth. And greetings to the author of the book, I think, Chip.
Yes,
no,
hi.
Actually, I didn't know about... Hi. Can you hear me? Can I be heard?
Yes.
Okay, great. Yeah. No, Gus, to answer your question, I didn't actually know about Bruce by name, but I actually am a VCU alum, and I actually, when I knew you were coming on the show, I didn't know that you were in the Richmond area or that your work actually kind of centered around VCU, because I actually did a lot of work for that burial ground that used to be a parking lot. I feel like you're familiar with it. Where they used to snatch a lot of the bodies. Yeah, so I'm very, very, very close to it, but I didn't know about Bruce by name.
Mm-hmm.
So my question, the first is, in addition to Bruce and your research on Bruce, what other egregious acts, other than the body snatching, because I'm familiar with that, and I mean, for me, this isn't new information that those kinds of things happen, but what other kind of egregious things did you come across that maybe were not necessarily focused on Bruce? And then my second question is, I understand that you're a journalist and that is your primary, like, occupation or identification factor, whatnot. Like, you're not really, you know, an activist when it comes to replacing the system of racism, white supremacy. But as a white male journalist, I'm very curious because I like to know, you know, if you do this work, you're proclaiming to, you know, want to spread information and help non-white people in some way. What is, after all that you've looked at, whether it was from, and I'm very familiar with that big cigarette down in Richmond, too. I'm right outside of Richmond. But, yeah, based off of what you, you know, from looking at that all the way to MCB, VCU, Shaco Bottom, African Slave Burial Body Snatching, what would you say, and actually, if you can answer this one first, because this is my most important question.
Okay.
What would you say to non-white people, what would you say to non-white people, particularly black people, as a way to, number one, combat racism, white supremacy, or what should we know about white people that maybe we don't know about white people, as you were able to find out in your research, or just as a white male journalist? Is my question clear?
What we don't know about white people that we should know regarding medical care?
No, not regarding medical care, just in general.
In general?
Just in general. So okay. I'll make it clear. You're a white man talking to some non-white people, and we want to improve our lot as non-white people. What is the best information or the best advice or something we don't know about y'all that we should know? What would you tell us?
Wow. I would say, I mean, that's a great question, and, you know, I don't have a flip, you know, or immediate answer to it except to say that that there's too much, we talked about the coded language of the 19th century early on, there's too much hesitancy for people to be honest about their thoughts or their experiences with other people in terms of establishing trust with each other. So obviously, I mean, that's not news to anyone who's non-white, that people aren't being completely upfront with what they're thinking. And so I think that it's good to have an honest dialogue with me about these issues. So to the extent you can have honest dialogues like this, I think this is a good time, you know, because as we've seen here in Richmond, you know, with so many things going on, just like around the country, with getting rid of the statues and taking a hard look at how we treat each other. And how we can keep trying to do better in new ways. And I'm seeing that at VCU. I'm seeing that at VCU Health to some degree, but I'm not seeing enough of it. So to the non-white people at VCU, I would say, you know, put the pressure on to get an apology for how Bruce Tucker was treated, but how all non-white people were treated. And that hasn't happened yet.
Can I please ask a follow-up question really quick?
Of course.
Okay. Okay, just really quickly. I wasn't going to comment, but I just have to. Do you really, as a white person, think that an apology does something for non-white people? And I don't mean that, I mean, honestly, if this is an opportunity to be 100% honest, do you actually think an apology does something for non-white people? Thank you, and that's my last question.
Yes. I know it would do something for the non-white people who are in the Tucker family, because they've told me it would do something.
I reckon that answered her question. Much obliged, Emmy. Our caller in California, 1159, 1159. Did you have a question for Chip Jones?
Yes, sir. Thank you for the program. Thank you for the guest. My question is, how do you suspect white people have continued and refine their business of stealing black people's organs and body parts?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that? How have white people done what?
Continued and refined their business of stealing black people's organs and body parts.
Mm. That is, to be honest, I don't have any knowledge of what's going on, if there is something going on right now, because that's not something that I have dug into. It's a great question.
Is there anything in your book that mentions Prince Philip allegedly getting about 8 heart transplants? Or do you know anything about that?
Did he get a number of, I don't know that. I would be surprised if one could get more than one or heart transplant, but I guess anything's possible. I don't know that.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Much obliged. Kendrick Johnson, I think that was the final audio segment that we had at the beginning of the program. He died under very suspicious circumstances. I think it's been about 6 years now, 7 years. They just reopened the case in Georgia, but they exhumed the body and missing organs. I don't know if that got as much attention, but this was like CNN, mainstream media outlets talked about this as well. Lots of, you know, same issues. Let's see, the person, let's see, caller in New York.
Good evening. Good evening to the guest, Chip, and to you two guests or the callers. It just seems like today with access to the dark web, the cryptocurrency, that these organs would be stolen a lot more. Do you think that this practice is still happening where white people are stealing non-white people's organs?
Well, again, that's outside of what I research. I know, having read news reports, that there certainly are a lot of questionable activities around the world. I mean, I've read in news reports about people going to, I believe, Egypt and to give up kidneys because they thought they could get paid a certain amount. So, but again, for me personally, it's all just like you, as a consumer of news, seeing things and there's no doubt that there's still a lot of bad practices around the world. I don't want to go outside of, you know, the sphere of what I know from my own personal research. It's a good question.
Okay. Back to the definition Gus asked you at the beginning. Do you agree that white people are dominating and subjugating all non-white people currently on the planet?
I believe, yes. I mean, I think the systems of governance, of there's so many things wrong with our systems of healthcare, the lack of affordability, you know, Affordable Care Act, medicine, still working on it, lack of access to.
I'm talking dominating and subjugating. Everyone is following their laws, their mandates, their orders. Worldwide, I'm not talking about just here in the United States. That's obvious.
Okay. I don't think of it that way personally, as far as myself trying to dominate, because that's not how I see myself. But it's you know.
Okay. But what about your people in general?
My people? The people I...
Your white people. You said you're white, right?
Well, yes, but I also have... you know, the interesting thing to me, and I'd love for Gus to talk about this a little bit, about, you know, some of the research in anthropology, which is, of course, that the creation of these false definitions of race have been used to dominate people. I mean, that's been proven over and over now, but... I don't get up in the morning.
Who created the notions of race? What group of people?
It was in the early 19th century, is my understanding, and I'm not an expert in this, so you correct me if I'm wrong. But when the with all of these different classifications were created, and they created this idea of the Caucus Man. That's where the term Caucasian came up.
It was,
white people did create that.
Okay, no problem. Oh, did you say you grew up in the D.C. area, or
did
I hear things?
I did.
Mm-hmm. Chocolate City, is that why they call you Chip?
I like that.
My question, in perspective to that, of course, in a chocolate city, it's a lot of black people. You were the minority. How particularly did you practice racism against the black people in D.C.? I'll be online. Thank you, Gus.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. How did I don't think of my time around Washington as far as my own life in that way. I was very fortunate to, as I said earlier, to, for one thing, get to play a lot of basketball in D.C., and that was a great experience. And, I think that at the time I was also fortunate to know a number of students who are friends of mine and fellow athletes. So I was fortunate. Not every white person I know was. They weren't fortunate enough to have black people in their lives, but I was lucky, and I still am.
Context of white supremacy, Thomas in New York. That was Thomas in New York. Thought I was confused. Did you think, I know you, as I said, you kind of wrapped the book up talking about your effort to track down Bruce O'Tucker's son, and I guess him maybe not being so receptive to chatting. You already mentioned that you were successful with talking to former Governor Wilder and some of the other black participants. Mm-hmm. Did you get the impression that any of the black people were suspicious of talking to you as a white man and thinking, hey, this white guy might be about practicing racism. I don't know if I want to talk to him.
I did not have that sense from Abraham Tucker, his son, but maybe I was wrong. You know, that could have been part of it. I think that he's been wounded by a lot of things, and certainly losing his father at such a young age was part of that. I've been told by a family member that the book has been helpful to him, but I have not been able to have a face-to-face conversation, even though I've tried to have it. And you know that if you read the book, but I've tried since then. But if it's ever the right time for him, I'm happy to talk face to face. But if it isn't, I respect that. I think that one of the positive things from the book is that it's helped to open up some eyes at the medical school in terms of talking about difficult issues such as we've been talking about tonight, that's how I would answer that. But I could be wrong on anybody not wanting to talk to me because I was white.
Okay. I had a passage that I wanted to read specifically, but okay, that's legit. On page 19, chapter 19, time of the trial, and just for clarity, of course, they do not win this trial. Douglas Wilder loses. They're not going to convict these white doctors of stealing a white heart. Incidentally, did you get any pushback from any of the folks involved at this project? The name of the book, The Organ Thieves? Anybody, hey, what do you mean calling us thieves here?
I got informal pushback, yes, Gus. Again, language, context. The title was actually not my idea. It was actually the publisher's idea. And you probably know, interviewing a lot of authors, a lot of times you start a book and it has a certain title, and the publisher comes up with this one, and it was, you know, it's a hard-hitting title, and I accepted it. You know, it was kind of a challenge for me, because there were no, you know, criminal charges that anyone had actually stolen the heart, and there was no civil suit that, you know, came out in the that said that, you know, in favor of the family that it was stolen. But I did feel all along his heart was stolen, and actually one of my working titles was The Stolen Heart. So go ahead.
Oh, my fault. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
So the title was an interesting process for me.
What was challenging about the switch to it being the organ thieves, and then you said The Stolen Heart, that was one working mm-hmm. title. What was your title going to be if it wasn't going to be The Organ Thieves?
There were a number of working titles. In fact, one of them was Heartless. And I like that title because I felt like it captured the treatment as well as, you know, the literal event of the book. But we went with this one, and I'm glad we did.
And the challenging part, what was challenging about accepting that title for you?
Well, first of all, it wasn't my idea. And I think for any writer, we start out with our own ideas, and sometimes it can be hard to be more collegial, but the other part of it was it made it more dramatic, and that was good. But I just had to accept the fact that that was very, you know, in your face type of title, and that was good. I accepted that.
And you said you got informal pushback. What was the mm-hmm. nature of the informal pushback?
That it would be from older white doctors who admired the accomplishment as they saw it, which is, of course, if you read the book, you'll see that I basically puncture a hole in the myth of it being this great first heart transplant in Virginia history. I'm questioning their view of the past. As we all know, that can be a hard thing to accept different viewpoints of one's experience. And they knew these doctors who did the work, and they just did not agree with my premise that they had knowingly done anything wrong. And I stuck to my guns on it, and here we are.
Now I can get to the passage. Chapter 19, this is Time of the Trial, which again, Doug Wilder takes an L, of course, but he fought valiantly. You write, with his wide forehead, aquiline nose, and strong chin, the Honorable A. Christian Compton seemed to come from Central Casting, a modern-day Atticus Finch ready to tackle a case that already had shaken the confidence of the MCV surgeons and drawn criticism in the African American press. I'll stop here. What did you mean with the comparison between the judge for this case, Judge Compton, comparing him to Atticus Finch from the acclaimed Harper Lee novel To Kill a Mockingbird?
Well, it was an acclaimed novel at the time, wasn't it? That's all. There wasn't a whole lot to it. It was just to describe. He had a resemblance to Gregory Peck, the actor in the movie.
Okay, that's interesting. I'm sure you're aware, or I'll ask, are you aware, Atticus Finch is often cited as another white angel and mm-hmm. even a white anti-racist, as someone who fought valiantly mm-hmm. like Doug Wilder and took an L for Tom Robbins. Was there any sort of anti-racist comparison or suggestion?
I'm sorry, I did not follow that. About Atticus Finch, the comparison to what? Can you help me with that? I'm sorry.
Atticus Finch, his character in the book To Kill a yeah. Mockingbird, he's thought yeah. of as this anti-racist great white guy okay. So were any of those characteristics, him being this great anti-racist white guy, were those supposed to be applied to Judge Compton? Because that's
I see. I apologize. I would actually have to go back and read the passage more closely, but I recall I recall talking to Doug Wilder about Compton, and that he did respect Compton as someone who was fair-minded, at least for the day, for 1972, and that he Wilder expected to get a fair shake in his courtroom, and it turned out that he felt that he had not gotten that, and I include a lot of that in the book about how Governor Wilder feels that he there was pressure brought to bear on Compton, but about to change basically what would be allowed into the jury deliberations and this the whole idea of wrongful death, and a brain death. And actually, the fairness part about Compton, as I think about it, when you ask me that question, it comes back to Wilder, and Wilder expressing to me a sense that he thought that Compton was a fair judge. Now, afterwards, I don't know that he felt that way, but he did going into the trial.
That's, again, why I interrogate metaphors when we have authors on, even in the book club, interrogating metaphors. Just that is, and it's even, in fact, even more interesting because for so many years, Atticus Finch has been heralded as a well-meaning, not racist, white guy. But then if you follow the follow-up to Kill a Mockingbird, Go Tell a Watchman, Atticus Finch is indicted as a racist, a white man who despises school integration, is horrified by these black children going to school with his white children, and everyone is all appalled and surprised. It's like, well,
exactly. No, I that's it's fascinating.
Very much interrogate the metaphors. Did the Tucker family, like for Mr. Tucker's son or the family or anything of the sort, did they get any like proceeds set aside for the book, like a scholarship or anything like that?
Not yet. I mean, I hope that VCU does step forward, but from me, that wasn't possible. I don't have those resources at this point. It would be nice though to do that.
On. Just for our listeners, like, it is amazing the timing of us reading this book right now. In fact, even we opened with Harriet A. Washington at the beginning, and she gave her brief, you know, few thoughts about the organ thieves, Chip Jones. Do you know the date when she did that interview, Chip?
I don't.
April 4. Just a couple days back, I said it for a pause, the date of Dr. King's assassination, which is discussed in the book. And then in the book, he talks about Charles Manson. We just talked about Charles Manson days ago, came up in the book club. Also, he talks about the attorneys, because this ends with a big trial and all that. And he talks about F. Lee Bailey, former guest on The Cows, not that long ago, just a few months back. And then, of course, Orenthal James gets mentioned. We just finished that in the book club. I said, I can't believe it. How does O.J. Simpson pop up in the middle of this book? Did you watch the trial, or did you have any thoughts on Orenthal James? Or that was just a casual mention because of F. Lee Bailey and the trial aspect?
Yeah, I did. It's so long ago, and I didn't get to watch the trial while it was happening, you know, because I was gone during the day working. But it was interesting to me that F. Lee Bailey was alluded to by the attorney for the MCV doctors as someone that this defense lawyer for the surgeons. Really disliked F. Lee Bailey. He called him Flea. So that was the extent of it in terms of why I brought it in, because F. Lee Bailey is a very famous trial lawyer, including with the O.J. Simpson trial and the other one that led to the movie The Fugitive. I think that was one of his first. Sam Shepard. The murder trial in the late fifties in Cleveland. I think that's where F. Lee Bailey made his first mark. So just mostly just his fame and his notoriety is why I included it.
Did you think O.J. was guilty, innocent?
Oh, I would rather not discuss O.J. Simpson, if that's okay.
Right on. Just he was in the book. Anybody, since now that we read the book on the O.J. Simpson trial, his name comes up so many times, we'll be reading about all kinds of things. Like, we've been reading books about 19th mm-hmm. century diet, and somehow O.J. Simpson pops up, and they're like, Jesus, why is... Six degrees of O.J. Simpson. Somehow, some way, everything comes back to the O.J. Simpson trial. Anywho, I think we did. I'm just circling back before we let you go to the caller who said he did not read the book. So I guess he said his question wasn't as pertinent. Did you want to get your question in before we allow Chip Jones to enjoy the rest of his Tuesday?
Yes. Hello. Thank you for taking my call again. Mr. Jones. Through the course of you gathering information, were you ever dissuaded by anyone that you know to not write about this topic?
Was I ever dissuaded to not write about it?
Anyone that would encourage you not to write, take on this type of topic?
Not really. You know, once I learned that the story of Bruce Tucker had been left untold for 50 years and no one else was going to write about it, I felt called to do my best job, and that's what you get in the book.
Okay, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Much obliged. Much obliged. I did learn quite a bit. As I said, it's a little embarrassing to be a student or an alumnus, University of Virginia, and to know absolutely nothing about Bruce O. Tucker. So I did learn quite a bit and am thankful we were able to discuss the organ thieves, the shocking story of the first heart transplant in the segregated South. Chip Jones, the author of the text. Much obliged for hanging out with us this Tuesday evening, reading the text. We will, share, tell other folks to check it. I guess to make this relevant to things that are happening now, I think folks, a lot of younger folks would know Kendrick Johnson and the gym mat down in Georgia that got lots of attention. His organs were missing. That alone should make this real relevant, the organ thieves, what we've been discussing. Much obliged, Chip Jones. Thank you for your time and hanging out with us this evening.
Thank you, Gus.
Enjoyed it. Evening, sir.
Good night.
Context of white supremacy. Carry me back to old Virginia. Started out the program with that, Doug Wilder. I should read his biography, even if we don't do it on the program, just as someone who was born in Virginia. I should read his autobiography. I should read his autobiography. I'm sure I would learn quite a bit. I think this only gets like a passing mention, if I remember what Mr. Jones reported. But regardless, I'm sure he has quite a bit to share about racism and his time being an elected official in Virginia and practicing law in Virginia. Anywho, reading more important than watching television. We'll be back on Thursday with the book club, Last Man Standing, The Tragedy and Triumph of Geronimo Pratt. We'll take a quick pause, and then we'll see if folks have any thoughts, questions that they would like to share before we wrap things up. Context of white supremacy.
And from the late 1960s, after the death of Martin Luther King and the riots and the upheavals and all like this, and black people with their fists in there and all like that, and trying to stumble and fumble and find their way and get focus, the white supremacists made a blueprint and put it in action. And that is, I'm going to have these people so confused, they don't even know what they started out to do. And by the late 1970s, they had just about completed it. And we've been on that ever since. And you mentioned something very important. They are more comfortable than ever. But see, it's like making gorillas comfortable in a cage, or monkeys, or pandas. You still got them in a cage, but they're comfortable. See, so give him some bling bling. It's like giving an animal a brand new car and training the animal to ride up and down the street in it. And then you stand back and point at the animal. Like one white man said in the late 1950s, he said he doesn't care what kind of car a Negro has. He said he's still a nigger. And when he rides by in a shiny car, to him, it's just a monkey in a car. White people built the car, put a monkey in it, trained the monkey to drive the car, so now you're looking at a monkey in a car. See, but black people don't see themselves that way. But this is how the white supremacists see us, and they are the ones who run our business. And we have to know that, that when they look at us, that's what they see. That's what they see. And at a subliminal level, what they see begins to spill over into our brains so that we, at a subliminal level, see each other that way. And indirectly see ourselves that way.
This is from Chapter 7, Restless Genius. Chip writes, Dr. Hume didn't always get his way, though. When the Medical College of Virginia Hospital administrator learned he was operating on animals in the regular operating rooms for human patients, he was told to stop. He was also ordered not to operate on corpses, which he used to obtain kidneys for experiments. Hume ignored the ban, though. When he sent some associates to retrieve yet another dead body from the morgue, an attendant tried to stop them. Hume, not one to listen to a lowly attendant, did as he pleased. When the administrator, Charles Cardwell, heard about it, he went ballistic. A truce was called, though, and an agreement reached. Hume could use an abandoned labor and delivery room in St. Philip Hospital, the segregated hospital for black patients, to cut into corpses and operate on chimps, monkeys, and baboons. The segregated system of medical experimentation took considerable creativity and logistics. It required moving patients, donated organs, animals, and sterilized equipment up and down elevators and through an underground tunnel linking the facilities. Somehow Hume and his close-knit team of surgical residents and nurses made it work. He goes on to talk about more of their operations on monkeys and black people and all the rest of it. Anywho. Reading, more important than watching television. Incidentally, I will say, I didn't know anything about Bruce O. Tucker. Nothing. Never heard of this incident. They took his heart. Sobriety would be best. That they took his heart to give it to this white man who lived, like, I think 7 days, they said. The rejection rate was really really high. Failure rate was really high at this point. So he didn't even live that long. But yeah, I had no idea. I knew about the general history of organ theft and abuse of black people in life and afterwards. But just for being someone with connections to the Commonwealth state, I'm glad to know about this story. However, this, I would say, is another great illustration. I heard about this book from Harriet A. Washington and her critique on saying that, you know, he could have been more direct. I think some of the listeners who seemed like they actually read this book on a saying, it seems like you're pussyfooting with some of the language here and talking about dirty deeds and some of the things, bad behavior, or what is it, regrettable legacy and that type of thing, which is very common in the way that white people use language to very much sanitize, obfuscate, acts of terrorism. Let's make it plain. Let's be direct. And there was a pattern of that throughout the interview. Man, I think the word fair was used this evening more times than any guest in years. Just that alone, as opposed to justice, logical, justice, fair, fair, fair. Also, even just word usage, angel. That's one that I pay attention to. As I said, that's so common that I think a lot of people have caught on. Like, why is it that it's always, we got to be reminded that this black person, frequently this murdered black person, was not an angel. Eric Garner was no angel. Why is that the case? Like, that was why I asked that question in that order specifically. I wanted to see, now, who is the first person that he's going to name as an angel? I know goodness well it's not going to be, you know, Lupita Nyong'o, Lil Wayne, Sherman Helmsley. You know, I don't think so. I could be totally, Meghan Markle. I don't think it's going to be somebody that looks like that. I could be totally wrong. Morgan Freeman, Charles S. Dutton, Chris Rock? Didn't think so. But I think a lot of folks have caught on about the angel component. That's why I say those metaphors, they're so consistent. Even Atticus Finch there, like, this is a white person that regularly would be mentioned as an angelic white man who was willing to sacrifice all to brave to help a raping Negro. Turns out he was just a racist if you keep reading enough. But pay attention to the metaphors that get used, especially if people are kind of lazily invoking metaphors. I'm not saying that Chip Jones was doing that, or I'm not saying that he wasn't doing that either. I'm just saying that particularly when people are not really invoking a lot of thought, like they're not being deliberate with their metaphors, like, ooh-wee, very frequently it's going to be something that reinforces notions of white terror, power, domination over non-white people. Something in that, you know, way of thinking. Let's see. Anything else I want to make sure I get in? I can't say that enough. Like, man, this story may not have happened. I mean, they would have killed or snatched up another black person, but just Bruce O'Tucker specifically may have, you know, lived out his life and done whatever if he just had not been drinking. Unless, you know, there's some errors and missed information, but I mean, drinking, they say you consume alcohol, you lose your equilibrium, right? Balance isn't as good. Falls backwards, injures his skull, and bang, dead, stolen heart, and kidneys. Sobriety would be best. Let's see. Oh, and making sure as best you can that you can have people with you at the hospital. We talk about that all the time. Now, in this case, his family was looking. They didn't get an opportunity to be with him, to aid him. But I mean, man, if you need any reminders, if you can help it, if you have to go to a medical facility, try to have people there with you who can advocate on your behalf, because it's, you're not supposed to be thinking correctly if you're sick. Even if you're still conscious, you're not going to be, your brain computer won't be working at its best. You need someone else. They don't have to have a PhD in biology. They don't have to be a doctor or nurse or anything like that. Just, I'm sober. I'm not asleep. I'm paying attention. That's really the major requirements. And you can ask a question. If it looks like they're going to do something, just make sure, break it down to me like I'm 7. What are you doing? What are the risks? That's always a great question to ask. What are the risks? Are there less risky alternatives, like organ donor? No, absolutely not. Do not consent to any organ donation at all. Never. No, absolutely not. Like, no, 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 no. All day long, if you're not the closest of kin, if they try and do that, try to be dialing and texting as quick as you can and voicing, you know, staunch emergency appeals that, you know, whoever the closest of kin needs to get here quickly. But I mean, that's such a vital role, just to have someone who's there who can advocate and observe what's happening when you are, you know, sick. You know, that's why you go to the hospital, to get healed. Keep the coon man clutches off of you. Can't emphasize that, and I'll end it there. The coon man, med school, the photographs, whether he was the Klansman or in blackface, he was in med school. Said that throughout the whole COVID-19 situation, the cigarettes too, he talked about that, the cigarettes, and his reporting on the tobacco industry. Man, through and through, the coon man and race soldiers in general, terrorizing and targeting black people in all areas of people activity, whether it's Philip, and it seemed like he wasn't entirely ignorant about that in terms of black people and the impact of all that nicotine and menthol cigarettes on black people. Who's most, oh, I should have asked that one for our mom in Michigan, who's more confused about racism. But I think you got the answer. It was self-evident from the program tonight. He didn't exactly seem ignorant about racism. That's it. Folks who dialed in, if you all have any thoughts, final comments, I guess I'll get some of the people we missed or that didn't get to ask a question at all. Caller, I guess you're in Southern California, maybe? Did you have a comment? Were you just listening based on what we heard?
I'm Black H2OML. Can you hear me?
You can be heard, sir.
I just wanted to make a comment on my, because it's a heart transplant thing. My wife was a recipient of heart transplant. I have called in a few times, but I haven't called in a while. Even after someone receives, just for information for the Cal listeners and yourself, even after someone receives a heart transplant, the hospitals pretty much regulate and own that person, per se. I remember we're in Southern California. She got a heart transplant through UCLA. We had to sign off on paperwork saying that if she doesn't take care of herself and doesn't take certain meds that, and she gets sick, that they could actually call the police and have her removed from the house and bring her to the hospital until they get her right and back on her regular meds and her medication. And so I was just, you know, sharing the inverse of that. So even though what happened to the black male was horrible, even if black people do receive transplants, it's like the hospital does on you. And then one more last thing I want to say, the doctor that voted for her to get the heart transplant, when we came back to do labs and stuff, they signed her up for some clinical trial, and I had read medical apartheid prior to and while she was in hospital, because I sat by her bedside for 2 years straight while she was going through this whole process. He said that you should do this trial because if I didn't vote for you, you wouldn't even got the heart transplant. That's all I have to add to today.
Wow, that is so unethical. Talk about now we talk about consent. Now, when they talk about informed consent, I told you we went over this with Alan Hornblum. He wrote Acres of Skin. He wrote Sentenced to Science. It is supposed to be free will. No coercion. That's why I said you go to the prison population because you can, hey, you know, you do this and we'll give you $50. We just talked about all the prison gruel that you get to eat. $50 on your commissary looks pretty good, right? Coercion. Supposed to be free from coercion. What in the world? You know, you wouldn't have that heart if I hadn't stuck up for you. We don't just give hearts out to niggers around here. So go ahead and sign up for this experimental trial. You're like, do what? Jeez. I guess, man, much obliged for sharing. That's amazing. His wife got a heart transplant. That's amazing. Wow, that's amazing. I hope she's healthy and seems like they still give you a little medical apartheid. And then they can snatch you. Like, if you're not cooperating, as he said, you're not taking your medication or following whatever the procedures are, that they can call the police, Mark Furman, and have you snatched and hospitalized until, you know, they say that you're correct, you're healthy and can go back out again. Like, wow, that is fright. That would be something to consider, like, before you hop into all of this. Like, wow, amazing, absolutely amazing. But wow, I'm glad to hear your wife is well. Hope she has many, 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 many decades of great health and vitality left to go. That's amazing. Let's see, other folks that we did not. Did we get, I think we heard everybody else, maybe. Maybe we heard from everybody else. I think we heard from everybody else. Other folks have commentary that they want to make sure they got in.
Yeah, Gus. Caller from New Jersey.
I guess we'll get our caller in New Jersey first, and then we'll nab our second caller as well.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting. I didn't read the book, but when we're talking about organs as it relates to Black people or just organ trafficking in general, the case in New Jersey, people can find it on NJ.com, the New York Times, the Wired.com, and it states man pleads guilty in trafficking of Black market kidneys in New Jersey, Black market, whatever that means. And also implicated in this case is three New Jersey mayors and five rabbis. You would think something like that would get more publicity, but wow, just kind of like the disregard for Black bodies. But we're definitely valued in death. It continues.
Much obliged, caller in New Jersey. I'm getting the report from NJ.com. They have lots of them. I'm even thinking I might. Oh, and it's kidneys, too. It's ridiculous. Standard system of white supremacy. But yeah, I'll post it so that people can check this out. I think I do recall seeing some of this from way back when. This is like 2009. But a Black market, whatever that means. Michael Brown Jr. is no angel. He's out trafficking on the Black market. Maybe our other caller in Ohio. Did you have commentary, sir?
Hello, Gus. Thanks for bringing this book to my attention. It's got a lot of great information, and you mentioned a lot of the common tropes that you talk about. They also talk about Dick Gregory being a racist, and there's a Toni Morrison quote, etc. The person that really resonated with me and got me kind of emotional about the book was Mr. Tucker's brother, William Tucker, who was with Wilder in the lawsuit. This is a man who was stricken with polio and was on crutches. And just sort of the difficulties and just the racism that he had to endure and just trying to find out and achieve some measure of justice for his brother. But thanks for bringing this book to my attention. I don't know if I enjoyed it, but I certainly got a lot of great information out of it.
Much obliged, sir. I would concur. I'm not sure I would say it was enjoyable. Like, it's no Medical Apartheid. Be clear. But I didn't know about Bruce O. Tucker as someone who, spent a good amount of time in VA and speaks about racism. I should probably know about Bruce O. Tucker. And I didn't know that Doug Wilder, Governor Wilder, was involved in this case. So, yeah, not medical apartheid, but even with that, I would say, like, I guess in some of the questions that you asked, some of the questions that I had, some of the content like Harriet A. Washington and talking about, if she was talking about if she had written a book about Henrietta Lacks and talking about her efforts to write that book and being thwarted, how she had white people obstructing her, what they wanted her to talk about versus what she thought was important about this Black female being mistreated, Henrietta Lacks. And she was applying the same to this book, The Organ Thieves, and saying, hey, we're doing some pussyfooting here, and talking about laws about consent and not just saying, hey, they're terrorizing this Black male, and putting that within a historical context. Even she has the section, I wish I had asked this before I let him go, she has this section in her review. She says, in the 1950s, for investigational purposes, and she has that in quotes, researchers at the Medical College of Virginia deliberately inflicted third-degree burns on the skins of 100 patients a year at Dooley, a charity hospital for black children, and at St. Philip's, its sister hospital for black adults. I feel like a really high-quality text, this would be a part of the context of the presentation. Like, even what the caller said in New Jersey, like, you don't have to give me every single case, but I mean, this is such a broader part of medical apartheid, white terrorism in terms of the medical profession, that I think this is why, as like a white person doing this work, and or a non-white person who is not really competent and not well informed to really connect all the dots and then to courageously write this out and to articulate it so that, hey, we're not just going to sit here and halfway glorify these white doctors and kind of cut them some slack about this. We're going to give the grisly picture, put it in the greater context, and not, like, that's pretty major because that happened at the exact institution that we're talking about. These folks deliberately inflicting third-degree burns, presumably on children, because she said on the skins of 100 patients a year at Dooley, a charity hospital, no less, for black children. Like, what in the world? Like, that's what I mean. Like, that right there. Deliberately burning black children. Like, let's not pull any punches. Like, let's not pussyfoot. Let's make it plain what we're talking about and what it means to be classified as white. Book would have sound radically, I think it would have been a radically better book. This and the book on Henrietta Lacks, if Harriet A. Washington had written that book, or Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, third generation physician. It would have been a radically better, different, improved book. Other folks have comments here that they want to make sure they got in. Everybody satisfied. I thought it was interesting as well. He does mention O.J. Simpson in the text. I mean, obviously, that's not the focus of the book, and it only comes up as they're heading towards the trial, big trial at the end. That's it. Doug Wilder loses. How's he going to win? But he mentions F. Lee Bailey and all that, and he didn't said he didn't want to comment about O.J. Simpson at all. I just find that interesting. People will mention things kind of like that in their text and then not want to say a word about it, especially at this point. Like, wow, now that, you know, presumably Cal's listeners are substantially more informed about the O.J. Simpson trial. Like, oof, my eyes light up anytime I see a white author mention O.J. Simpson. Like, really? What are your thoughts? Do you think he was guilty, innocent? Did you want, like, lots of questions? What do you think about Johnny Cochran? Like, oof, did you know Mark Furman was a high school dropout? Like, all kinds of questions once they have opened the O.J. Simpson can of worms, as it were. But he didn't want to touch that at all. Let's see. But I assume folks are all good, satisfied, or what have you. Grand, we will be here on Thursday for Last Man Standing. I think audio session 7. We just talked about Charles Manson in the segment last week. And then he also gets mentioned in the section in the book we just read, where I just read for this, The Organ Thieves. But we'll resume Johnny Cochran years before he gets to O.J. Simpson and see how Geronimo Pratt is dealing with the COINTELPRO shenanigans and despicable charade to keep him in greater confinement. That'll be Friday or Thursday, excuse me. And then Neutralizing Workplace Racism this coming Friday. Compensatory call-in on Saturday, and Sunday we should have our Global Sunday Talk, catch up on what has gone down globally in the past, I guess, 30 days since we had that broadcast. Much obliged for the folks tuning in for this evening. Hope the program was worthy of your time and energy. Reading way more important than watching television, and spend some time learning your local history. It can be so informative with regards to white supremacy, racism, and just, man, you can learn so much about what it means to be white, just about, you know, how your town evolved and the history of, you know, your little county or whatever it is. You would be amazed. And like I said, especially if you have children. Easy way to study racism, white supremacy, what it means to be classified as white. That said, like, say it again for Mr. Bruce O. Tucker, sobriety would be best. They probably would have stolen a heart or whatever else from another black person. But if Mr. Tucker, counter-racist code involved, hey, I'm about sobriety, maybe we wouldn't have The Organ Thieves as a book, or at least Mr. Tucker wouldn't be the subject. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled if you got to go out. I still say hunker down. Is so much terrorism and all the rest going on. I'd be very leery about being out in public too long, in densely crowded areas and the like. If it looks like someone is being hostile and loud in public, run. Like, exit that area. You have no idea if they're armed. You should be thinking they might be armed. In fact, they might have a whole gang of hooligans with them who are also armed. If you didn't leave your residence prepared for armed to the death conflict, exit. You can report, call enforcement officers as you are leaving. All of that said, if you are going out, you are sober. You are buckled. If you are driving, you are not on the cell phone. Just doing the small things that we can to minimize contact with the Mark Furmans, Derek Chauvins of the known universe. And we need all of our attention. Be mindful about what's happening around us. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.